All right, the projector at this point does not appear to be working. This is not a catastrophe. I spent most of my life teaching without that sort of gadget and hopefully can still remember how to do so. Somewhat mixed views as to whether PowerPoints are good or bad anyway, although mostly students seem to think they're good. Right now I'm rebooting the computer on the off chance that that has something to do with the problem, and assuming it does not solve the problem, we will just do the class with verbal rather than visual aids. That still does not appear giving us anything. All right. So we've been talking about property, and we talked a bit about the bundling issue, which is that property rights to a piece of land are really rights to a bundle of property rights having to do with the land. And I suggested that Coase gives us a useful way of thinking about the question of what should be in the bundle, which is basically, given that somebody owns right A, is he the one who will most value right B? If so, put them in the same bundle. That's a simple way, but I think a useful way of thinking about that issue. And one of the implications is that what goes into the bundle will in part depend on the particular ways in which that land is being used. So that if you imagine land that is being used to grow timber, it's not clear you object to people trespassing across it as long as they aren't starting campfires or bringing axes with them or doing other things likely to damage your timber. Whereas if what you're using the land for is growing wheat, you're going to have strong objections to people walking across it. And if you're using the land for living on, you may at least have objections to people walking across it close to your house where they can peer in on your window, overhear your conversation, plot to rob you, and various other things of that sort. All right, so the basic lesson here is that you're constructing a bundle of rights, and how you construct it is going to be connected with how the land is likely to get used. Okay. Any questions so far on that stuff? No. All right. The next question that we got into, which is one that I think is one of the sort of really important questions people don't think about enough, is the decision of what things should be treated as property and what as commons. Now, there are other alternatives, obviously. You can have something which belongs to the government, which is a sort of property, but rather different from ordinary private property. But what I'm really interested in at the moment is the choice between it follows the ordinary property rules, which means it belongs to somebody. If it was created by somebody, initially belongs to him. He can transfer it to someone else, all that sort of stuff. Versus the rule which says it belongs to nobody, first come, first served. I can, if you imagine what the air or the water is like if you don't have any specific regulations on it. Anybody can breathe the air, anybody can put smoke into the air, anybody can dump stuff into the river and so forth. That's a commons. And there are advantages and disadvantages to treating things as a commons. And this is a point which we'll come back to either at the end today or Thursday when we start talking about intellectual property, because of course many, many forms of intellectual property are treated as a commons. And essentially all intellectual property was at one time treated as a commons. That, to the best of my knowledge, there were no restrictions on people reciting Homer's poetry without Homer's permission. I don't think there were restrictions on people making copies of Shakespeare's plays, though I'm not sure of that. It certainly predates copyright law in the modern sense. So in that sense, all of intellectual property is really an exercise in transforming a commons into property, and we do it to varying degrees with different parts, different sorts of intellectual property, which raises the obvious question of why. And we'll be getting to that, as I say, either at the end today or Thursday when we start talking about those questions. What are the reasons something should or shouldn't be property as opposed to commons? You want to plug this into the, to get rid of the sound, this goes into the headphone. Okay. All right. So whatever the problem was, you have solved it. How do I solve it next time?
Actually, it was the problem with the cables.
The cable wasn't connected to the other end?
Yeah.
Right. That explains it all, right? Thank you. All right, we're back in business. So these are things we discussed before, but here's the general issue of property versus commons. And there are clearly some things, such as the English language, which it doesn't make much sense to try to treat as private property. Other things it does. The advantages are an incentive to produce, not to overuse and to allocate property, but then there are disadvantages having to do with the cost of defining and enforcing property rights and transacting over them. And I mentioned an old article on primitive societies pointing out that some of them have property rights in land, some don't, some have it part of the year. And then mentioned some other examples where people choose to treat certain things as commons. That I could try to treat my web page as private property in the sense of having some system the way porn pages routinely do, where people have to pay a certain amount to be able to access it. My guess is that the cost to me in people not reading my stuff that I want them to read would be much higher than any income I could get from doing that, which is one reason why I've never bothered. Radio spectrum. In some ranges of frequencies, it's a commons, for example, Wi-Fi. In others, it is government property. The FCC says you can broadcast if you have a license, but there has also been a noticeable shift, originally due to an article by Coase a very long time ago, towards converting the radio spectrum into private property, somewhat restricted private property, by auctioning off parts of it for radios, for cell phones, and so forth. And you can see in that case that there are fairly strong allocational arguments for doing it that way, because if I am a radio station and I've got the right to use a certain chunk of the spectrum in a certain area, it's hard to see how I'm going to contract with a phone company to say, all right, I'll shut down my radio station, which isn't making me much money, and you can make lots of money running cell phones on this. Whereas if the government simply sells it off as property, now the cell phone can simply buy up. If the government owns it, the radio station can't let the cell phone company use it. The cell phone company doesn't have a license. Whereas if we treat it as private property, then any user, whether radio, television, or someone else, has an incentive to say to himself, would this spectrum be more valuable to someone else? Could I use a narrower slice of the spectrum to do the same thing and sell off the rest? Could I move to somewhere else in some other range of frequencies that's less important to other people? And thus you would have the potential for reorganizing the whole thing efficiently. This is only partly happening because, as I understand the system, maybe some of you know more about it, the auction typically includes restraints on how that part of the spectrum is used, so that what they're doing is not saying, you own this spectrum, I can use it for anything you like, but we're going to auction off a chunk of spectrum to be used for cell phones, but different bidders can put in bids. But even with that system, since the government would like to get money, there is at least some pressure on them to try to figure out who values the spectrum for what use most and to arrange to do it that way. Right? Larry Lessig, a prominent sort of high-profile legal scholar, has argued for a while that we ought to make the whole radio spectrum a commons, and his claim is that with current technologies, that's actually a more efficient use. And one possible response to him is, if he's right, then if we make it private property instead, you would think it would pay somebody to buy up a chunk, a noticeable band of the spectrum and say, all right, this is now a commons, but we charge for access. Right, it sounds a little bit inconsistent to have it commons and charge for access, but anybody who's eaten at Fresh Choice knows that that's one option. You say, once you're inside our boundary, it's a commons, take as much as you like, but we charge you to do it. You could imagine pretty easily a system where we say, you can do any broadcasting you like in our frequency band, but only if you have a piece of equipment which has paid the licensing fee that we charge for equipment that uses our band. So that would be a case in which you had essentially a privately owned commons, and if it's really as useful as Larry thinks, you would think that would be likely to happen. So any questions so far? This is really going over stuff I did last time, but I figured it's been a long time, so I might as well go over it. Before I go on, let me just stop for a moment and ask whether there are any questions that occurred to any of you, either going over your midterms or in terms of reading that we've done, that I ought to discuss before I do my sort of canned account of the material for today. Nobody? All right. One of my puzzles for many, many years is why the public lecture survived the invention of the printing press. That on the face of it, it seems as though I can do a much better job of conveying information to you by writing a book where I can be very careful and, you know, rewrite it 73 times and you can reread the parts you don't understand than I can by what I'm doing at the moment. And yet, when I once tried the experiment a long time ago in a different school of saying, all right, here's the manuscript of the book, come into class, if you have any questions, ask me, if not, go home. And nobody was very happy with that. I'm not quite sure why, but the obvious advantage of a live class is that you can answer questions, so if you think of any questions, feel free. So what are the problems with private property? Why isn't it the right solution for everything? One problem, which isn't too obvious at first, is that in order to have a private property system, we have to somehow draw lines around chunks of property. We have to say, this is the thing you own, that's the thing he owns. And pretty easy to say, this computer is the thing I own. A little harder with land, for reasons we discussed before. Do my rights include the right to take away the chunk of land along the border that's keeping your house from sliding into my hole? What do my rights include in terms of mineral rights, of support rights, and so forth? But there's also the problem which I discussed, which I like to illustrate with Stack Island, that when you make your rules, you may think you've got a bright line rule. You may think it's obvious who Stack Island belongs to. And then, because it never occurred to you that islands actually move due to erosion and deposition, it turns out that you've got two different people, each of whom, by the rule he's got, is the owner of Stack Island. And I discussed the case along the Nile, where the Nile shifts, and there the traditional system which adapted to that was to define property claims relative to the Nile bank, not absolute. So if they had gotten GPS devices, they would have been worse off, not better off, assuming they tried to use them for that purpose. But the next one, which any of you who've actually taken courses in patent ought to be familiar with, is the problem of drawing a line around an idea. All right, what does a patent cover? I have a patent on something. What is it? What do I own? Have any of you taken patent courses? Yeah, I figured somebody must have. I own the right what?
Right to sue infringers.
Infringers requires that we have a definition of what I own, though, right? I mean, if I own a piece of land, I have the right to sue trespassers. But that doesn't tell me what it is, right? I mean, I don't have the right to sue United Airlines for crossing over my land 3 miles up.
Said another way, you have a right to prevent other people from making, selling
it,
whatever it is,
doing a patent. But what do I own a patent on? What kind of thing? Here's my patent. It's written down somewhere. How do I find out what activities of his infringe? What is it that I own? What have I drawn a line around with my patent? Anybody? What do the textbooks say I own before we get into figuring out what it actually means? Copyright, I own an expression. What do I own if I have a patent?
An idea.
An idea, that's what they all say. What does it mean to own an idea? What are the boundaries of an idea? All right. Theoretically, if you implement my patented idea, you are trespassing on my property. But how do we figure out where the boundaries of an idea are?
You have to screw your claims and mark material.
That is, you try to set out when you write your patent application what ideas you are claiming. And it is very, very unclear in general. My favorite example, I don't know if I mentioned to you, was that Samuel Morse attempted to patent the Internet. If you actually look at his initial claims, they included all means of using the electromagnetic force to transmit letters or symbols to a distance. That would cover the Internet. What did he actually invent? A telegraph. But of course, he wasn't patenting the telegraph. You don't patent things, despite the way we often talk. You patent the idea embodied in the thing. And there are a whole lot of different descriptions, narrower or broader, of what the idea is of which a telegraph is an implementation. All right. So that's a case where you have a real problem of defining what you own because ideas don't have sharp boundaries around them. Novels have sharp boundaries around them, much closer to sharp boundaries. What's the fuzzy part? If I've patented a novel, what's the fuzzy part of my ownership? What might you be able to do without my successfully suing you?
Taking the ideas.
That's not even fuzzy. Right? You can say, well, he had a novel in which giant dragonflies wipe out mankind. I'm going to write a novel in which giant dragonflies wipe out mankind. No problem at all, right?
I mean, sentence and word order are too close, but maybe chapter order or paragraph order.
But you can also quote a paragraph from it. Fair use, which is a pretty fuzzy concept, means that small bits of it can be copied, large bits of it can't, basically. But it's nonetheless much closer to a sharp definition than what you own when you patent the telegram. So one problem is that in order to work out property, you're going to have to be able to define fairly clearly what you own so people will know when they're trespassing and so the court can figure out whether to award you damages or whether to arrest people for stealing your property, depending what kind of property system it is. And that is going to be relatively easy for some kinds of things and very hard for other kinds of things. And the second problem is that you have to enforce your rights. It does no good. There's a famous line from the President of the United States, I think from Andy Jackson, the Chief Justice has made the law, now let him enforce it, prior to his evicting the Cherokee from their land, if I remember the case correctly. I think that's the one where that statement was made. And the court said he couldn't, and he said, tough luck, I'm going to do it anyway. So in order for it to be of any use, you have to be able to enforce it. In fact, have I told you my Muslim poet story, which is about enforcing the law? This is one of my good medieval Islamic law and econ stories. The poet Ibn Harma performed before the Caliph, the Prince of the Muslims. And so delighted was the Prince of the Muslims with his performance that he said, name your reward. And Ibn Harma answered, the reward I wish from the Prince of the Muslims is that he send instructions to his officials in the city of Medina, commanding that when I am found dead drunk upon the pavement by the city guard and brought in, I be let off from the punishment prescribed for that offense, which is 60 strokes of the lash, as it happens. And the Prince of the Muslims answered, that is God's law, not mine. I cannot change it. It's Quranic law, not civil law, so to speak. And name another reward. And Ibn Harma answered, there is nothing else I desire from the Prince of the Muslims. And so the Caliph took thought, and he sent instructions to his officials in the city of Medina, that if anyone found the poet Ibn Harma dead drunk upon the pavement and brought him in, Ibn Harma should receive 60 strokes of the lash as the law commanded. But whoever brought him in should receive 80. And ever after, when someone saw the poet drunk upon the pavement, he would turn to his companion and say, 80 for 60 is a bad bargain, and pass on. You see, that's a law and econ story, right? The point is, he can't change the law. He can merely make it not in the interest of his people to enforce the law, which is what he did. So I then have my story about why we own private property for the dog to the dogs, where the basic argument is just that in a primitive society, it may be very costly to prevent trespassers who want to pick your fruit when it's ripe after doing none of the work or harvest your crop or whatever, come in at night. Dogs provide a cheap burglar alarm, so conceivably, I don't know if it's true, but it's possible, the domestication of the dog shifted private property and land from something that cost more than it was worth doing to something that cost less than it was worth doing, and thus set off all of the progress that led us to this very luxurious world that we are lucky enough to live in at present. Finally, there's the issue of creating rights. And in many contexts, that's an advantage of private property, because if the rule for creating rights, as for writing a book, for example, is you write the book, you own the copyright on it, great, that's an incentive to write books. That seems like a useful thing. But if we have a form of stuff that's there already, such as the surface area of North America, when the white men arrive after they've driven the Indians off or made it clear that they're going to have the military force to ignore Indian land claims such as they were, which in many places there weren't any, depending on whether that tribe recognized private property or not. So you now have this whole valuable area. How do you turn it into private property? And the answer for a very large part of it was homesteading law. And I argued that the homesteading law creates an incentive to inefficiently early settlement. That what happens is you say to somebody, look, there's some really nice land out there beyond the edge of settlement. If you owned it today, you'd lose money. But if you owned it 10 or 15 years from now, it'd be worth a lot. You'd be an important landowner as the edge of settlement moves out. People are moving in from Europe. Our population is expanding. And so the potential settler says to himself, if I go and farm that land at a loss for 10 years, which is roughly, I think it was 10 years for Homesteading Act, something like that, if I plant a fruit tree, which at one point was one of the requirements, and go to a lot of trouble to keep that damn tree alive in a place where fruit trees don't normally grow, and meet the other requirements, 10 years from now, I am going to have, was it a quarter section? Anybody know what? How much did you get with the Homesteading Act? Was it a quarter section would be a quarter of a square mile? I think that's what it was, but I'm not sure. I will have a quarter of a square mile, and I, of course, will pick to do my farming what looks to me like the most valuable land out beyond the frontier. So I'll have a quarter of a mile of first-rate land, which will support me and my descendants for the next 200 years in fine style. So it's worth losing money for those first 10 years. Losing money, losing effort, whatever, in order to get that valuable property. And the problem, of course, is that if you're giving away $10,000 worth of property and it only costs $1,000 to get it, there are going to be too many claimants. Some of the claimants say, well, I'll settle earlier. I'm, in effect, paying $2,000 in costs to get it. Someone else says, I'll pay $3,000. And if you work through the logic, you're going to dissipate the value of the land due to people settling prematurely early enough to, so that nobody else wants to come before them, which means that they are, roughly speaking, paying for that land in farming it too early as much as it's worth. Is that argument clear as a potential problem? And this is a problem referred to as rent-seeking. It's an idea that shows up in lots and lots of other contexts. I've sometimes called it, I think, Friedman's second law, which is the government can't give anything away. All right? And it's an exaggeration, but it's an exaggeration of a real problem. If the government says, we want to help blind people, right, that seems like a really unambiguous doing good to people who need it. So if you're blind, we'll give you a $10,000 a year pension. Then the obvious question is, how do you define blind? All right? I've known people who were legally blind, and they weren't really blind. They were just very, very, very close to blind. All right, they could see very, very badly. Well, if you're in that situation and the government says, if you're officially blind, you get a $10,000 pension, you have an incentive to try to act more blind rather than less blind than you are. And so at least on the margin, you'll have the person who, if he did the very best he could to cope with his the limitations of his vision, could get a decent job and support himself. But he says, no, that's a lot of trouble. I will instead accept the pension. He's paying, let us say, $10,000 or $9,000 in employment losses for his $10,000 pension. Now, that's blind is a pretty good thing to subsidize because there are lots of people who really are blind unambiguously. But even in that case, to some extent, you're going to dissipate what you're giving away. And if you think about lots of other cases where you say, we want to help people of class X, give people an incentive to put themselves in class X even if they don't have to. Think about unemployment compensation where the question is can you or can't you work? It is, are you going to hold out for a reasonable job used to taking advantage of your abilities which pays a decent wage, or are you going to go find the first McDonald's and hiring people to flip burgers and say, since I don't have a job as a nuclear engineer, I'll flip burgers for a while until nuclear engineer jobs come through. You can see that the more generous the unemployment compensation, the less incentive there is to do that. So that's, as I say, that's the rent-seeking problem. And in the case of homesteading, you can at least argue that the result was an enormous loss of value due to premature settlement. And as I mentioned, there is an argument I've seen made that it wasn't really a mistake at all, that settlement that was premature from the individual standpoint might be optimal from the national standpoint because the government wanted people out there to scare away the Indians or to make sure the Canadians didn't get the Pacific Northwest instead of us and things of that sort. And as I also pointed out, the solution that was suggested by the people who first pointed out this problem, which was auctioning the land, was in fact tried prior to homesteading and ran into fairly serious practical problems as well. Any questions there? I think I discussed some of that in the book. I don't remember. But I discovered that when I actually found a book on the history of the homesteading, of the public lands, actually. So those are problems. Those are reasons why you might not want to make something property. What are the benefits? First big benefit is an incentive to produce. If when I create something, it belongs to me, I can sell it to you or use it myself, that's much more reason to create it than if as soon as I create it, anybody who wants can grab it, which is what would happen in the commons. How important that is depends on to what degree people are producing in order to get money. And that's where, as I say, since intellectual property is one of the issues, if you think about novels, do you know anybody, are there any of your friends who have tried to write a novel? I know lots of people who have, in fact, written unpublished novels. That's probably because I know most of them online, where people discuss some of those issues. It's not all that uncommon. And you might argue that the main reason to write a novel is you have a story you want to tell, that writing novels doesn't require expensive ingredients. All you need is a word processor. Indeed, I'm told that there have been novels that are written with paper and ink in the distant past. So, therefore, you might argue, even if we didn't have copyright law, just almost as many novels would be written anyway, because people want the fun of writing, telling their story. They want to have people read their story and tell them how great it is, stuff like that. And, in fact, if you think about the history, an awful lot of what we think of great literature predates the Copyright Act. Anybody know when the first, at least Anglo-American, Copyright Act is? No?
I think it's
in the 18th century, and it's the Statute of Anne, and I think it's like 1710, 1719, somewhere around
there.
Are you
thinking British?
Yes.
Oh,
America, and you've got copyright in the Constitution, so that would be the 1780s is when
1794
for the U.S.
Statute of Anne.
Oh, 1794. It's later than I thought. Anne is 1794?
1794.
Huh. That's interesting, because that's after. Are you sure?
Because
that's after the U.S. Constitution. And I'm pretty sure that Anne, because Anne is the daughter of William and Mary, and William and Mary come in the Glorious Revolution, which has got to be like 1680-ish, 1690, somewhere around there.
1710,
that sounds right. That's right. 1710, I think, is right. Yeah. The
Wikipedia, man.
I was looking at my copyright notes.
Yes.
Yes.
The... Yeah. Now, English history around that period is actually quite interesting. You know, we think of England as a very stable system, and then you look at the 17th century, and they have a civil war, they cut off the head of the king, they then have a second civil war, which ends up with a military dictatorship by Oliver Cromwell, who is military dictator for 14 years or so, and he dies, and his son tries to take over, and there's a military coup to get rid of the son who's incompetent, bring back the son or grandson of the king whose head they cut off. And then a little while after that, they decide they don't like the Stuarts after all, so they throw out the Stuarts and bring in a German royal They bring in a Dutch. They bring in William of Orange, who's a Dutch prince, basically, to be king of England. And then he has, I think, a daughter and no son. And then she has no children. And so they import the Elector of Hanover, a German who I don't think even speaks English. And he's the ancestor of the present English royal line. So quite a lively period of 100 years or so. Anyway, So as I say, Homer, Dante, and Shakespeare didn't have copyright. They managed to produce pretty good stuff anyway. On the other hand, the counter-argument, again, if you talk to people who want to write novels, is it's all very well to have this unpublished novel, but to be willing to give up your day job and spend all of your time writing novels, which we would like the really good people to be doing, that requires you to get some income from it. Right? So probably the answer is, yes, we would have novels. We'd have some good novels, even without copyright law, but one suspects that the people who are now the most productive novelists would be a good deal less productive because they'd have to do other things too. But anyway, incentive to produce in the case of things where you think the productivity doesn't depend very much on that, maybe it isn't important. One of the things which occurred to me recently is if you watch World of Warcraft, people are spending a lot of time and effort doing stuff there, and all their payment is in virtual gold, which they can't eat. So that's a case where it looks as though people really are willing to spend time and effort producing stuff just for the fun of producing it. Second, private property system means that things go to their highest valued use. And oddly enough, that is not an argument in the case of intellectual property. What is the proper allocation of a novel? How many people ought to read my novel? If we have an intellectual property system, and if I charge, obviously, in order to read the novel, I have to get a physical copy of it or download it from the internet or something. And if it takes a physical copy, you shouldn't read it unless reading it is at least worth the cost of somebody producing that copy. But with a copyright system, if you buy a copy of my novel, you not only have to pay the cost of printing it, you have to pay me a couple of bucks royally for having written it. If the reading the novel, suppose that producing the book costs $10 and the royalty is $2 for a moment. If the value to you of reading the novel was $11, would the world be a better place on net? Would, in terms of economic efficiency, would you be better or worse off if you read that novel? You're reading the novel, costs $10 to print it. I get $2 royalty, worth $11 to you. If you read a pirated copy, and if you wouldn't have bought it, that is, I'm assuming it's worth only 11, so you wouldn't pay 12, is there a net gain or a net loss from that transaction? Anybody? Be great. Is there? Why? How much better off are you when you read the book?
$12
But you're not going to pay $12. You're reading a pirated copy. You're going to pay $10. And how much? It's worth 11. You pay 10. How much better off are you? You're a dollar better off. How much worse off am I? You wouldn't have read it, right? You wouldn't have bought paid me my royalty. How much worse off am I for your reading it?
$2.
No.
Zero.
You weren't going to pay me $2, right? If it was worth $13 to you, then I'm $2 worse off when you pirate it. But then you're $3 better off when you pirate it, after all. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. So the point is that the normal rule of allocating stuff is you pay the cost of producing one more. The cost of producing one more copy of the book is a real cost. But the cost of producing one more copy of one more intellectual property, the contents of the book rather than the physical book, is zero. It doesn't cost me any more indeed, in that particular case, it's negative, because I'd rather, if you write a book, you want people to read it. So my guess is that the average author, if you could really somehow say to the average author, we've got some way of separating out the people who won't buy your book, can they have it for free? He'd say, sure, of course, if you could really do that, because I'd rather have 20,000 people read my book than 10,000. You know, I wrote it because I had a story to tell her. Doesn't have to be a story. It would be a nonfiction book like Law's Order. All right. So the efficient allocation of intellectual property is to everybody who values it at least its physical cost of production. And any property system is with royalties is going to result in the people who value it only a little above its physical production not getting it. So that's an argument against property for intellectual property. It's an argument for property for wheat. Because in the case of wheat, if I get the wheat, you don't get it. But if I read the book, that doesn't stop you from reading the book. All right. If I photocopy the book and give a copy to him, that doesn't stop you from reading it either. And if he is somebody who wouldn't have bought it, it does no harm to the author. It does some good to him. So that's part of why intellectual property is more problematic than other forms of property. Because one of the function of getting you to produce stuff, it's still got. But the function of allocating stuff to people who value it more than the cost of production is done by giving it away, because the cost of production, the marginal cost, the cost of producing one more copy to the producer is zero. And finally, in the case where stuff is getting used and can be overused, the sort of classic tragedy of the commons, property gives you an incentive not to use it up unless it's worth at least as much as it costs. So if you think about a salad bar, all you could eat salad bar, it's true there's an inefficiency there. That last serving of salad was only worth $0.10 to me. It cost them $0.15 for the lettuce and tomatoes, net loss of $0.05. But since the marginal cost of salad is very low, the actual cost of producing me another service serving is low, the fact that I buy it, that I eat it, even when it's worth more than zero but less than the cost, is only a small inefficiency. On the other hand, if a piece of sushi costs $1 to produce, and given an all-you-can-eat sushi bar, I'm going to keep eating this stuff until the last one is worth a penny to me. That last one was a 99-cent inefficiency. It cost them $1 to produce it, worth a penny to me. So generally, the incentive not to consume is a bigger argument for things where the cost of producing is higher. So in summary, treating something as property rather than commons has costs. The rent-seeking problem when you propertize existing stuff, the cost of defining and observing property lines, cost of enforcing property rights, and the cost for transacting over property. I went over to that when we started out with the English language in the book, that it would be a real pain if you had to buy the right to each word before you used it. Okay. On the other hand, it has benefits. It allocates things to the highest valued user. It gives people an incentive to produce things worth producing and not to overuse them. And how large those costs and benefits are depends on what the things are. And therefore, it makes sense for a legal system to treat something as property for things where the benefits of treating this property are larger than the cost and not when they're less than the cost. And that's going to be sort of the basis on which the chapter on intellectual property gets built, because I'm going to argue that you can make at least some sense out of our intellectual property law by saying that it's designed to be more willing to treat things as property the more they have benefits and don't have costs doing so. Questions? All right, let me mention at least briefly a number of sort of cases where we observe things of this sort. And one respect in which the Internet is a commons is things like passing on email. That the basic rule, as I understand it, probably isn't true for the people with the backbones, but for everybody else, is I will pass on your packets, you'll pass on my packets. Or rather, I assume you know that when you send an email to somebody, it's not going directly from your computer to his. It's going through umpteen intermediate computers, each of which is sort of passing on that information in the direction they think is most likely to reach the intended target. And they aren't sending you a bill for each of those, because those would be bills of, you know, a hundredth of a cent each, and that's not worth doing. The issue of the Internet as a commons has been a sort of public issue over the last decade or so. Again, one of Larry Lessig's projects. In that case, it's a mistake, because he doesn't really mean commons, even though he says so. What he really means is a commodity. And the argument that he's made is, at present, when I do stuff over the Internet, the people who are transmitting my packets don't know what's in them. And therefore, I can think up a new way of doing something useful by sending information back and forth over the net without having to negotiate with all the intermediate people to get their permission. And that in that respect, it is like a commodity in the sense that when I buy a bushel of wheat, the seller doesn't have to know what I'm going to use that wheat for. All right? Whereas you can imagine other cases where people who sell you something do care what you're going to use it for. For example, we have various systems. I think it's the case of the law school. I don't know what our system is, but it's fairly common to have systems where if you get a law degree and then do some sort of legal practice that somebody thinks is particularly virtuous, you volunteer your legal services to a nonprofit or something, some part of your debts might get forgiven. I have no idea whether this law school has that, but it's a common arrangement. And one way of putting it is that we are selling you legal education, but we're selling it cheaper if you use it for purposes we approve of than for purposes we don't approve of as strongly. And so the question is, what if a carrier wants, as some carriers sometimes want, to say, actually, we will charge you more if you want to be able to download movies over the net than if you want to be able to do something else? And are there good reasons for and against? And the argument for keeping it a commodity, basically, is that it makes innovation easier. Because you and I are on opposite ends of the Internet, as it were. We think about something new like voice over IP, which we think is a really valuable use. in order to do it, we've got to get all these people in between forwarding our bits back and forth. We don't want to have to clear permission with all of them before we do our new innovative use. And therefore, it's easier if the rules of the game are if you have a connection to forward your packets. But the argument against, there are two arguments against. One of them is that downloading movies takes an awful lot more bandwidth than sending email does. And voice over IP takes a lot more bandwidth than just sending text. So you, if I'm a high bandwidth user, the result is either that somebody has got to have wider pipes along the system or that other people's uses slow down. So since it's not, it's at least difficult for most parts of the net to actually charge you by bits transmitted, one way you might do it is to say, we will only connect with you if you agree that your users can't download movies or can't do voice over IP, because if they can do those things, we know that you're going to have huge amounts of stuff coming through. That'll slow down our system. And second reason why you might want to discriminate among uses is that you might want to be able to guarantee a higher quality of service to such users. So that if I am sending email, a 3-second delay is absolutely irrelevant. If I'm playing World of Warcraft, latency of 3 seconds means I'm not going to play. I'm going to just quit until the latency goes down to the 1/10 of a second or so that people are used to. Maybe 20th, maybe 2/10 is all right, but not much more than that. And similarly, if you imagine virtual surgery, it would be a real pain if the bits stopped being transmitted for 15 seconds while the patient bled to death. So you can imagine a variety of cases in which a provider might want to say, if you're going to do A and B, we will guarantee you high-quality service, but at a higher price. So as in many cases, there are arguments on both sides. And I have tried unsuccessfully to persuade Larry many years ago, when I was writing a long critique of one of his books, that if he wants the internet to be a commodity, he should probably be against zoning laws too. Because the logic of the argument is exactly the same. If you think about zoning laws, which say you can't have a grocery store on your property because this is a residential district, the argument against zoning laws is just like the argument against requiring permission for non-standard uses of the internet from the people transmitting your bits. The argument is that if I want to do something new, I've got to get permission from all my neighbors, or I've got to go to a lot of trouble to lobby the zoning commission, and therefore innovation is going to be slowed down. If we've got it zoned for residential, and I say, well, I've got this great idea, I want to have something like the old medieval European setup where people lived over their shops. So I want to build and sell or rent out structures where the first floor is a small shop for a craftsman, maybe, and the second floor is residential. Sorry, can't do that, zone residential. But the counter-argument, the argument in favor of zoning, is to say, my neighbors care what I do with my property. If the result of my putting a movie theater on my residential property is that there's no parking because when I'm showing a movie, the street's parked up for 3 blocks in either direction, that's a cost on them. If the result of my putting a whorehouse on my property, supposing for a moment that such things are legal, is that kids, that my neighbors have to explain to their little kids why all these men are going in and out of these houses and why there's a red light over it, scantily dressed women in the window and such, that's a cost to my neighbors. If I have a fur factory in my house and my neighbors are people who regard killing animals for fur, they're vegetarians, they're vegans, they don't wear leather or fur, and they get upset at knowing that evil things are happening near them. Right? You can think of all sorts of ways in which my use of my property might impose direct or indirect costs on my neighbors, and then the argument for zoning is to reduce that. And my point vis-a-vis Larry's argument is that he is trying, that zoning forcibly makes me require other people's permission to do stuff. What he doesn't want to allow people to do is just to say, well, I won't transmit your bits unless you restrict it these ways. Questions? Comments? No. All right. Yes?
Isn't there a difference, though, in terms of location? In the sense that if I want to be able to do whatever, all I have to do is buy an area of property outside of the zone or in an unincorporated area, whereas the internet, because everything's connected, if everything between me and you decides that we can't do a certain service, then even though I bought service that allows me to do it, you bought service that allows me to do it, we still can't do it because there's no way for us.
But notice that requires everything between us, and as long as there's one path between us, we to some extent still can't do it. This is the somebody's sort of classic comment that the...
But when that, if there's only one path, presumably the costs of our service becomes astronomically high.
But there being only one path is, in fact, very unlikely on the Internet. Sort of classic comment on the Internet is the Internet interprets censorship as damage and roots around it. So it would really have to be a case where a noticeable number of people in particular, maybe some of the main trunk line, whatever they're, I forget what they're called, carriers would object to carrying something. But in any case, there are lots of things that people want to do in urban areas. Right? I mean, when I want to set up my craft shop where passersby can drop in and look at my woodwork and maybe watch me working, and I'm going to live above it and so forth, I don't want to do that out in, 3 miles from anyone. I want to do it in a place where there are people coming by. And if the zoning law says we don't allow that, I'm not going to be able to do it. Question? No. All right, let me go on to the rebundling issue, as I see it. And that is that one of the respects in which land, which lawyers have this quaint habit of referring to as real property, differs from unreal property like my computer, is that real property can be rebundled. That is to say, the property, as we said before, is a bundle of rights. But as any good Coasean would expect, would hope, what's in the bundle can be changed. So that one of the things that I assume some of you have taken, I guess everybody's taken property law, right, by this time, isn't that one of the first year standard stuff? So you know about easements and licenses. You know that basically I own a piece of property, I sell off a chunk at the back end of it to you for a summer house, and you say, oh, by the way, I can't get to this without crossing your land. And I say, well, that's all right, I don't mind your crossing my land. And you being prudent say, well, you don't mind my crossing your land, and you're a nice guy. I mean, we go golfing together and everything. But you aren't going to own that property forever, and I'm not going to own the property forever. And the property I own is worthless without the right to get to it over your land, so let's put this in writing if you don't mind. And that's called granting an easement. And you, the owner of the big parcel, basically says the other guy has a right perhaps to cross via that route or to cross via some convenient route. I don't know, you people probably know more than I do about the way these contracts are written, but essentially I'm granting him a part of the bundle of rights to my land, namely the very limited use of using my land to get to his land. And what is special about that as opposed to other ways I grant people's rights is that what I've granted is attached not to me but to my land. So that if I contract, if I sign a non-compete agreement, that non-compete agreement only applies to me. Doesn't apply to people I've trained, for example. If I sign a agreement saying that my favorite absurd example is that I buy your car, you're a very, very strict Orthodox Jew, and not only do you believe that you shouldn't work on the Sabbath, you believe your car shouldn't work on the Sabbath, and that applies to what used to be your car, so you'll only sell the car to me if I agree that I won't drive it between sunset on Friday and sunset on Saturday. All right? One pretty weird thing, but I find weird examples are easier to remember. So we signed that contract, that's fine. You buy the car on those terms, and if I see you driving on Saturday, I could, in principle, sue you for damages for violation of contract. Now you sell the car to him, and I see him driving on a Saturday. I say, what are you doing making my poor car work on the Sabbath? And you say, why shouldn't I? It's my car, isn't it? Not your car anymore. And I, but he agreed that it wouldn't be during the Sabbath. Well, go argue with him. I got no right over you. All right. So the difference between the kind of rebundling that we do by property law and the kind of sort of rebundling we do by contract is that the right is attached to the land and the property case, and thus the restriction is still a restriction on the new owner. Calling it a restriction is sort of odd. A different way of putting it is he never owned the right to keep the guy at the back of the land from from crossing it, that got sold off before he bought the land. Any more than he owned the parcel that got sold off, right? That got sold off before he bought the land too. But then that raises the interesting question of why we do it that way. Why don't we, one way of putting it is why do we allow it for property, for real property, but the other way of putting it is why can't I sell this computer with restrictions that are attached to the computer instead of to the buyer or the car? Why can't I sell my car and have that restriction run with the car? Well, as a matter of fact, there's a case in which I can. What restriction runs with a car? When I sell the car to you, what right, in effect, don't you get, might you not get, that has to do with the car? Anybody know? Car is not a random example. It's the only case offhand that I can think of other than land. Ever looked at the title of for an automobile? One of the things the title has on it is a list of liens against the automobile. So I buy my car from the dealer on a 3-year payment plan. 3 months later, I sell the car to you. You may think you own the car. What you actually own is the car combined with an obligation to pay the rest of those payments, and if not, the guy can reclaim the car. All right? So that's a case where the property can be sold, but it can be sold only with the restriction that it is security for a loan attached to it. And my understanding is that the way that's enforced, I don't think I've ever looked at the title either, but I'm told that one of the things that will be on the title for a car is a list of any liens against it. Okay. So that's a case where you can, where it does run with the property, but as I say, it's the only case I know of.
What about software, where they license it rather than sell it?
Yeah, but the answer is that in theory, at least, the reason they do it that way is that you, that is, I think they have sold the physical object, right? And they've licensed the intellectual property, isn't that right?
Right.
So you never owned it. So you can't sell it to him. Right? I think that's the answer. Or you can sell it to him only to the extent that they permit you to. I think that's the reason they do it that way. They can't sell you the program legally with a restriction saying you can't do X, Y, and Z with it, but they can sell you the disk and license the intellectual property with such a restriction on it. And I think that's why they do it that way. But someone may know more about that stuff than I do. So why do it in that form? Actually, I didn't even notice. I've been doing all of this from PowerPoint, from the editing interface rather than this interface. This makes it all a little bit bigger. I only noticed that when I pushed a button, nothing happened. So why the difference? And I don't know the answer, but the conjecture I offer is that the difference ultimately comes from information. That in order, if we have a system where there are restrictions attached to the computer, what do we have to do to make that workable? If it's the case that when I buy the computer, the seller can say, all right, I'm selling the computer, but minus the right to watch porn on it. Right, the seller is a puritanical sort of guy. He disapproves of porn. Porn is legal, we will suppose, but he sells me the computer only with the restriction that this computer may not be used to view pornography. Imagine we had a legal regime where he could do that. So when I resell the computer to him, he's not allowed to watch porn on it either. In order for that to be workable, what would we have to make sure of? We have to have some way of warning buyers, or some way in which buyers could be reasonably confident they knew what they were buying. And in the case of land, first we have an elaborate system of title registration, so that before you buy land, you do a title search, and one of the things that title search ought to turn up is the existence of easements or licenses on that land. Right? In addition to that, many of the things that one has easements or licenses for can actually be observed. That when, you know, there's this nice chunk of land that you,
and to go back to the story I was telling before, here's the road, here's my nice chunk of land, and I sold off this corner for your summer estate. Now, I want to sell this, and the title registry tells you that I only own this part, but I don't own this part. That's all right. But you might miss, perhaps, the fact that there's a easement giving him access, but if you miss the easement, you will notice this brown strip going from the road to his property where he's been driving his car back and forth every day across the entrance that I let him use. And you can think of a fair number of other cases, though not all cases. It's going to be easiest if you imagine the kind of society where land is usually being bought by people who've lived for the last 10 years in the neighborhood and therefore know about it, that you will have some reason to be on notice of such things.
And in fact, I think it's a fair statement that if you look at the details of property law, it is essentially easier to pass. An easement is more likely to be enforced against the new buyer the easier it is for him to find out. And the particular example that struck me when I was reading up on this stuff, which I don't think I saw an explanation of, is that an additional element of the bundle, as it were, which increases the value of the land, is more easily passed than one that decreases it. So that if I have given you an easement, and the result of this easement is that my land is worth much less, that the easement is an agreement that lets you do things that greatly restrict the value of my land, that then when he buys the land without knowing about the easement and then tries to break it, he's more likely to succeed if he can show that it was very hard for him to discover the easement, it wasn't on the title or something, than if we do it the other way around, if he buys the land and it gives you some set of rights that are valuable to you, some set of rights that are valuable to him, then the other person who doesn't want you to have those rights is going to have a hard time breaking it because the seller would have had an incentive to tell him about it if it increased the value. I discussed it in the book, and I'll probably get it more precisely correct than what I've just said. But the basic idea is it is easier to pass benefits than costs on the grounds that costs you have an incentive to conceal. And in fact, I discovered when I was reading up on Athenian law for my fun seminar on legal systems very different from ours, that one of the bases for our information about Athenian law are these stone markers that you find on property that was in ancient Athens. And what do the stone markers say? The stone markers say this field is security for a loan of 500 drachma made to the owner of the land and owed to Herodotus or whoever it is who it's owed to. And why is that stone marker there? Is it clear what's going on? Right? They want to make sure that when someone buys the land, he knows that the land is encumbered. And so part of the deal by which I borrow money against my land is that I've got to put a stone marker on the land, which means that the debt will then be good against anybody who buys it, because anybody who buys it obviously inspects it before he buys it, sees the stone marker, and realizes that this land isn't covered by a debt. So that's sort of a neat case where the same logic of passing things and making them observable goes back something over 2,000 years. I mentioned the case of a car. And then, since I like thinking about imaginary futures, I have this picture of a future where our information tech is so good that every magic marker has got somewhere a little tiny print that you scan, maybe as a barcode, its own serial number. Not for the model, right? This particular magic marker's serial number, and this particular MacBook serial number. And somewhere findable online is the database where you can check before you buy my MacBook to make sure you're allowed to watch porn on it. Because, you know, maybe at some point in the past, some anti-porn crusaders with lots of money went to Apple and said, look, we'll give you this big subsidy if you will agree that for the next year all the MacBooks you sell are restricted, they can't be used to watch porn. And you want to make sure whether you're covered by that, and therefore you do it. This isn't quite such a wild idea as you might think, because a couple of days ago the treadmill that I inherited from my father stopped working, and I was making phone calls to find out whether I could get it fixed, and I call up a place that's in the treadmill business, and she wants to know how old the treadmill is. I don't know, you know, my father bought it a long time ago. She said, well, can you give me the serial number? And I gave her the serial number. She says, well, it was sold more than 15 years ago. Because she's got a database somewhere, which does not, of course, show restrictions on the use of that treadmill, since there aren't any, but which does show some information about when what range of serial numbers were being sold. And so one could imagine carrying that farther, and pen number 1739206 may not be used for signing checks, because the guy who made the pen believed that people are wasteful of their money when they can sign checks too easily, and therefore the pen can't be used for that purpose. Or let me take a slightly less absurd example. Suppose I want to subsidize some activity. Suppose, for example, that I want to subsidize kids learning to use computers. And of course, there are projects for subsidizing kids learning to use computers. Suppose even that I'm Apple, and I want to make Apple computers very cheaply available in the schools, so kids will learn how to use them so that when they grow up, they'll want to buy Apple computers. And so I sell the schools a whole bunch of computers with the restriction they can only be used in the school. And a year and a half later, I discover one of those computers on eBay. What can I currently do as Apple under current law? What legal action can I take? Anybody know? Who has violated what? Can I go to the guy who sold, to the guy who bought it on eBay, let us say, and say, look, you don't own that computer unless you're going to use it in the store. Sorry, that's all it can be used for. That's needed to school. Can I do that? No, I can't, right? Who can I complain to? I can go to the school that bought it and say, your contract when you bought it said it would only be used here. And they say, well, you know, you're right, that's perfectly true, but, you know, this school went bankrupt. So you can sue us if you like, but there's nothing here. And when we went bankrupt, our property got sold off, and people who bought it did what they pleased with it. So you can see that in a context like that, it would actually be useful to have the equivalent of easements and licenses vis-a-vis land for computers. Because if I want to subsidize for some reason particular uses by making cheap computers available for those uses, that's a reason to want such restrictions. In a sense, I've got actually a real-world case in mind, not of such restrictions, but of uses. Do people know about the One Laptop Per Child project? Now, this was a project that was supposedly going to get laptops down to $100. They never actually did, by a good deal. I think the current deal is that you can buy two of them for about $400, and you get one, and one gets given away to a child in some third world country. While a bunch of well-meaning people were developing the One Laptop Per Child, a new kind of product appeared on the computer market, which got called eventually a netbook. And the netbook is, I think they're currently down to about $300, maybe down to $200 for the least expensive ones. And they are small, general-purpose computers. I actually own one. They're very nice. And I think that when Asus designed the first netbook, the Asus EEE, which had a little tiny screen and was very cheap, they were thinking about the same market, except commercially, about making it available for school kids who couldn't afford good computers. But it turned out that that wasn't the real market. The real market was people who wanted to be able to travel with a really small, really light computer, which if they did get sold and they didn't much mind, which would do 80% of the stuff they did on a computer, which a netbook will do just fine. It'll do word processing and spreadsheets and internet stuff, and it's not very good for playing World of Warcraft or for doing for editing movies or things like that. So you could easily enough imagine, if that hadn't happened, that if the One Laptop Per Child project had really gotten to the point where they were making them available in large numbers at $100, they might have discovered that of every 100 they produced, 95 ended up getting sold to businessmen or resold to businessmen, and only 5 ended up in their intended purpose. So that would be a reason why they'd want some restrictions. Anyway. But we now have my scheme for rebundling anything, which to some limited extent works. And that is that we know that land can be rebundled. We also know that we can add to the ownership of land other rights, so that we could add to the ownership of land the right to draw water from a well on some adjacent piece of land where the owner of that gives you that right. And I think, though I am not sure, that under some circumstances I could also sell you land with a restriction saying you can only buy your water from my well and not from other people's well. Whether that'll apply will depend probably on the state and the year I do it, but that sort of restriction is possible. So my general theory is that if I want to sell Macintoshes, which can only be used in schools, what I do is that I own a piece of land. I attach to that piece of land a right to use this particular Macintosh in a school. And I then sell you that, except that you give me an easement to use the land for all other purposes for the next 1,000 years. Again, I'm exaggerating a little bit. But the point is that to the extent that the legal system lets you rebundle the bundle of rights called land, there is the possibility of adding something to that bundle, then rebundling it, and thus getting restrictions or additional rights, changing the bundle that contains that thing. And in common law, they saw that problem and had a way of preventing it, which was something called the touch and concern doctrine. And the touch and concern doctrine says, sorry, but the use of a MacBook in a school does not touch and concern a plot of land in West San Jose. Therefore, you can't include that in that bundle of rights, and therefore you can't rebundle them this way. And the tendency more recently seems to have been for courts to shift away from the touch and concern rule and to say, well, a restriction not directly related to the land that's part of the land ownership is enforceable if we think it's reasonable and enforceable, and not enforceable if it isn't. Which I thought was interesting because I discussed a long time ago that two ways you could go after reading Coase are what seems to me the right way, whether Coase agrees, I'm not sure, but it seems to me the right way, which is to say, how do you create general rules that will, on average, allocate the right to the highest valued user? And the alternative is to say, well, each time we have a case, we'll decide who is the highest valued user and allocate accordingly. And the shift here seems to be at least in the direction of the second approach of the court saying, we don't care if your right touches and concerns the land, was it a reasonable agreement to make? All right. So now let's get the very beginning of intellectual property, which is what we'll be doing Thursday. How do you people divide? Let me think about it not as an economic issue, but as a moral issue. And the question is, do most of you have a fairly strong moral feeling that you shouldn't steal other people's computers and they shouldn't steal your computer? Most people feel that way or not?
Yes.
Raise your hands. All right. Not everybody would agree, right? There are people who say, well, you know, property is wrong, but it's a pretty standard thing. How about the intellectual property equivalent? Let us suppose that you have bought a computer program and your friend would like a copy of that program, which you're not allowed to give him under the license. How many of you feel that giving him a copy of that program is wicked in the same sense that helping him steal something is? How about from the other side? Let us suppose that you have produced some intellectual property. Let's suppose that you have written an essay, and you discover that somebody without your permission has put that essay in a book of essays and published it, sold it. Do you feel like you've been swindled, like you've been robbed, or do you say, well, yeah, it's just intellectual property, that doesn't count? How many people have the same gut level feeling to that story as they do when they realize that their missing computer is over there and somebody else has taken it? Yes? No? Yeah. You think you do?
I feel like you feel different feelings of like being cheated out of something. Like if your computer is throwing out like a price on everything and in your head, well, like if that happens, it wouldn't be so much as I want money, I just want some credit for it.
Well, that's an interesting question. Let us suppose that the person who publishes it says that you wrote it, but he did not have your permission to publish it. This, by the way, is a real example. I got an email, I think a couple of years ago, by somebody commenting favorably on the article of mine that had been in some newspaper in Canada, which was very interesting because I had never submitted an article to a newspaper in Canada. It was something I had published online my blog or someplace of that sort, that as far as I could tell, they just stole. But as, but since he, judging by the email, they must have credited me with it. Therefore, it was not plagiarism. See, that's, in the academic world, plagiarism is seen as worse than theft, really. And plagiarism is what you're really talking about, stealing the credit. So no, so we have only one person with, in any situation, strong moral intuitions for it. Because it's an interesting split. My guess, though I am not sure, is that if you went back 50 years, you would find stronger moral intuitions.
Which way are we supposed to raise our hands? I mean, I think,
The question is, first, in the case of giving somebody a copy of a computer program or a song or whatever, digital IP, that you're not, don't have the right to do it. Nobody feels about that the way they feel about stealing, is that right? I'm not saying whether you do it or not. Not is there anything wrong with it, but...
Right.
And I guess I'd have to say that's probably true of me, too. If I think about it, my rule of thumb for those issues, actually, is not to violate the copyright in ways that I believe the copyright owner would disapprove of. So that, for example, take the computer program, my actual policy, if I have a friend who I trust, and he says, I'd like to look at that program to see if I want to buy it or not, I would say, fine, I'll give you a copy, you know, erase it in a week or so if you decide not to use it. And if I trust him to do that, I wouldn't feel badly because I say, well, look, if I was the copyright owner, I'd want people to do that. Right? That in that sense, the rights they're asserting are broader than the rights they really want because they don't have any very good way of enforcing a more precise set of rules. But I wouldn't be willing, I'd be much less willing to do the same thing with physical property. If I say, I'm over in your house as a guest, you don't happen to be around, I'm having a phone conversation with a friend who really needs a book, really wants to look at a book, which I see on your shelf. Even, suppose I'm house-sitting, and I know you're not going to be back for a week. I feel very uncomfortable about saying it even to a friend I trust, I'll lend you the book, just bring it back within a week. So that there's a sense in which even my, I should say even, I don't know if every reason I should be any different, in which my moral intuitions about intellectual property are at least weaker than about physical property. But there is the opposite argument. And I observe this particular in arguments among libertarians, because some libertarians who feel very strongly about property, and some of them feel really strongly about intellectual property, the other are exactly the other way around, so it's sort of an intriguing tension. And the argument for intellectual property is to say, look, Apple didn't really make this computer. After all, somebody else produced this part, someone else produced that part. The ideas, some of the ideas were ideas they stole from Xerox, as everybody knows, and others were ideas in the public domain. They've got sort of a claim to own it. But my book, my God, my book used no inputs other than a little paper and pen, which is almost valueless, except my own mind. So you've got the view which says, look, intellectual property is the very purest kind of property, because we normally say you created something, yeah, that meant you played a role in creating it. But intellectual property is just out of your own mind, which is sort of the core of you. Poof, here is an idea, an invention, a book, whatever. That's sort of an intuition on the one side, and the intuition on the other side is to say, well, my intuitions are strong about physical property. This book is my physical property. I can do what I damn well please with it. Here's a Xerox machine. I'll make a copy for you. So that, at least, we'll get into the economics in a bit, but I just find it intriguing, especially because we live in a world where copyright is in the process of collapsing for technical reasons, for enforcement reasons, and it's interesting to see how people's moral intuitions do or don't react to them. Comments? Questions? All right, well, I'm talking about the moral philosophy stuff partly because we're really supposed to be doing the law and intellectual property Thursday anyway, and we had an extra 4 minutes to talk about it. But that's what I was doing, and I will let you interrogate your own moral intuition for the next 2 days and see how you really feel about intellectual property. To some extent, I think some of my feeling for intellectual property is not based on intuitions of property at all, but of promises. That I sort of feel as though I've promised the copyright owner to do certain things with the stuff as the condition of his giving it to me, and I'm therefore bound by the promise, quite aside from being bound by the property ownership. Anyway, get back to that later. Have a nice 2 days.
for this class.
I don't.
I can call your office later if you.
I'm just taking word in. Wait a minute.
It's in there.
You are Benjamin?
I am. Thank you. So what was the mean and all that?
That I can tell you, but just a minute. That information, as it happens, I have right here.